It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Coming up, we'll take a look back at the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty with a sociologist who says anti-poverty efforts have slipped after some early successes.
But first, it's January 6th. How are you doing with your New Year's resolutions? If you're starting to have some trouble following your resolutions, our next guest has some advice.
Juliana Brinas is with us. She's a postdoctoral fellow in psychology at Brandeis University. She wrote a piece for Psychology Today called How to Trick Yourself into Making Your Resolutions Stick. Juliana, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, we think of resolutions, making these big changes, as a chore, a labor, a lot of the time. Is that part of the problem and part of where we go wrong?
Yes, that is a big part of the problem. So even though we often are the ones who decide that this resolution is something we want to do, we sometimes underestimate how unpleasant it might be. So we have this big goal of going to the gym every day, but then when it comes down to it, it's actually pretty arduous, and we actually want to avoid doing it. So that's a big part of the problem.
And you describe something called reactance theory. What is that, and how does it play into our resolution efforts?
So reactance theory basically states that when we feel pressure to do something, we often will resist that thing. So we have a strong need to feel a kind of sense of autonomy and free choice. We really don't like to be told what to do. So research has shown that if we feel kind of pushed into a certain behavior or attitude, we may adopt the opposite behavior or attitude, even if that's not what we really wanted to do, but really just to show that we're in control. And not everyone shows the same degree of reactance, but it is something that can come into play with New Year's resolutions, because even though we're the ones who resolve to do something, it can start to feel like a kind of rigid rule. We're telling ourselves we have to do this, and that can kind of take away from our intrinsic desire to do it.
In your piece, you reference a noted scholar named Mrs. Pigglewiggle.
Yeah.
What is her story, and how does she help us meet those resolutions?
So the Mrs. Pigglewiggle book series is one that I read when I was a child and really stuck with me, and I've noticed it's still a popular book today. So what Mrs. Pigglewiggle would do, she was this little woman who lived in the neighborhood, and she would be called upon by parents in the neighborhood when their kids were misbehaving or had a bad habit. And she had a very unconventional approach to helping them. So instead of, if a child didn't want to clean their room, instead of ordering them to clean their room, she would say, actually, you should, her cure for the child was to let the child just be as messy as they wanted to. And so there's one story where a child literally becomes trapped in their room under all their toys. Or one of my favorites that I talked about in the article called The Radish Cure is about this little girl who doesn't want to take a bath. And so she is allowed actually to not bathe for weeks until she actually develops a layer of topsoil all over her body. And her parents plant radish seeds in that dirt. And she's so traumatized when those radishes kind of grow and are picked out of her that she's dying to take a bath. So I was influenced by that a lot when I was younger. And, a lot of psychological research and even psychotherapy approaches kind of go along with that idea. Obviously, you don't want to take it to an extreme where you hurt yourself, but sometimes actually what's called prescribing the symptom can be really effective.
So if my resolution is to get more exercise, say, what would I do? What would my opposite of exercise chore be?
Right. So that's a really common resolution. I think it's one that lends itself really well to this approach. So one thing you can do is, and you can really be creative with this. There isn't just like one way to do it, but it also depends on kind of how your habit works. But the opposite of exercise you could think of as just inactivity. So you could require yourself to sit on the couch for a set period of time, for example, 30 minutes or an hour. And during that time, you're not allowed to get up. And I actually think it helps to imagine that you actually are physically incapable of getting up, or you're on a plane and you've been on the plane for hours, and that starts to make sitting on the couch feel really unpleasant. So that the idea is sort of to reverse the role so that bad habit is now the chore that you're assigning yourself. And the desired behavior, going to the gym, is something that maybe seems a little more pleasant. So I think what's also important is that after that set period of time, you allow yourself to do whatever you want, and you still don't have to go to the gym, but or go exercise, but you basically give yourself that choice. And so the idea is to kind of tap into that intrinsic motivation that you might have to actually exercise. And you may, I think another key thing is you may actually enjoy exercising even more, because I think sometimes people, even when they follow the resolutions, they really aren't enjoying it and they're not getting as much out of it as they could. And so I think to kind of realize, wait, some people don't actually have the ability to exercise, and just realizing that it's really a privilege, I think, can help us not take those things for granted and actually want to do them.
So do the opposite thing. Make it a chore. Make the desired thing fun. And you also suggest that maybe we do it as a mental exercise. We imagine what would happen to us down the line if we smoke to excess today or eat too much or things like that, because that you don't necessarily want to do to the extreme.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good point that, you know, for certain things, you know, you wouldn't want to drink so much alcohol that you get sick, and that teaches you your lesson. You know, I think for those kinds of examples, sometimes it is more helpful to sort of imagine what would happen if I sort of overindulge, or kind of look at the future you, look at those different paths, and what are the benefits and what are the costs of going on that road or not. And really asking yourself, is this what I want? So it's not so much just to scare yourself, but because those kind of fear tactics don't always work, but to really ask yourself genuinely, do I want to go down that road with its costs and its benefits?
So a lot of this might feel counterintuitive. And here's another thing you say that sounds counterintuitive at first glance. Look at the thing you're trying to quit and think about the pleasurable side. Think about what we get out of it, not just the negatives. How's that going to help us?
Right. So I think that's really important, because I think that's part of why we have so much trouble sticking with our resolutions, because we really, you know, like I said, we think it's going to be so much easier to quit than it really is. And by seeing those benefits, I think we can be much more prepared for the temptations that are going to be there. And one of the things I suggest in the post is that if we recognize that we get these benefits, if we find other ways to get those benefits, we may be less tempted. So if we find other ways to relieve stress or other things we can do that are going to fulfill that same need, I think that can be helpful.
Because we don't smoke because of the bad stuff, the risk of disease.
Exactly.
and the bad breath isn't what makes us smoke. So we need to track down the benefits, the reasons we do it, and try to find something to take the place?
Yeah, definitely. I think part of that is to be, you know, not so hard on ourselves and recognize that we do have these needs and there is a reason we're doing these bad habits. We're not bad people. And I think that's an important component, because when we feel shame and we beat ourselves up over our failure to keep our resolution, that actually is counterproductive.
And I've been dropping the word resolution this whole time. And that's a concept that's been around for a long time. Is that a misleading word? Does calling it a resolution, making it at the beginning of the year, really help us?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think that even though in certain ways this is a great time to sort of have a new start, and the word resolution has a lot of strength to it, like it feels like something very powerful, but at the same time, I think it can actually trigger reactors just because it is so kind of strong. And so I actually think it can be more helpful either not to think of it as a resolution. You could think of it as an experiment. You could think of it as a question. You're asking yourself, what happens if I change this thing in my life, or, you know, what do I really want? So kind of framing it more as a question or something that's not, using that word resolution can be a little intense for people.
And Juliana, if it's not too personal, have you been able to put this into practice and make a change, a resolution or otherwise, in your life?
Yeah, that's a great question. So actually, the funny thing is, one of the resolutions I've always had and why I talk about this is to exercise more. And, you know, there's always, especially when you're a busy person, you can always find an excuse not to exercise. But I have to say that after writing this post, I got up, and just because I had thought a little bit about the kind of like being stuck and paralyzed on my couch, I actually went out and started running. And ever since then, I haven't been perfect, but I've been a lot more active just because I've been thinking about this a lot. So I do think that it really helps. And I mean, one thing I should note is that this was before the new year. So again, it wasn't so much, okay, I'm going to wait till January 1st. It was, wait, right now, I really want to go exercise. So it did help me.
Well, Mrs. Piggle Wiggle would be proud. Juliana, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Juliana Brinas, postdoctoral fellow in psychology at Brandeis University.
Up next, we'll talk to a sociologist about how the war on poverty has affected American families.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Later in the hour, Wisconsin Life takes us behind the scenes with doomsday preppers, people preparing for the apocalypse.
Now, though, this week marks the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's call for an unconditional war on poverty. That was followed by the introduction of some of the safety nets we see today, like food stamps and Medicare.
By some measures, the struggle to end poverty has succeeded, at least in part. For example, it greatly reduced poverty among the elderly. But many say the war ended without victory and that it might be time to relaunch that effort. Here with us to talk about the war on poverty and where we stand now is Philip Cohen. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and senior fellow at the Council on Contemporary Families. Philip, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
What prompted the war on poverty in 1964?
Well, we were coming off a period of prosperity and economic growth, and also a time of rising demands in terms of civil rights and women's rights. And there was a sense that government not only could but should respond to the needs of large numbers of people who were in pretty dire straits at the time.
Was this a bipartisan effort?
Well, it started by Johnson, but certainly carried on by Nixon without a big change with the change in the party in the White House. Nixon went on to continue Johnson policies, including increasing Social Security payments and even proposed a guaranteed income at one point, which didn't quite succeed. But Nixon was also on board for sure.
And what's happened to the war on poverty since then?
Well, the programs expanded greatly, like you mentioned, especially food stamps, Medicare and Medicaid, school lunches, and really lifted the floor for people who were at the bottom of the income ladder. And that went on through the 70s and into the 80s. And, there's a big economic shift. The economy turned around in some ways. We had two bad recessions in the 80s, a shift in the political mood, a decline in labor unions. The whole gestalt changed. And all of a sudden, the size of these war on poverty programs came to be a sign of failure rather than a sign of success. So the number of people who were receiving AFDC, the welfare for single mothers, poor mothers at the time, or food stamps, was a sign that we were failing rather than a sign that we were helping people in need. And the political winds changed into the 90s.
Let's talk about some of the people who were affected. Now, in particular, the elderly, how did they fare?
Well, that was the biggest early success, was cutting poverty for the older population, which was growing and continues to grow now. And that was the biggest thing was Medicare, but also the expansion of the other programs and disability benefits also helped the elderly a lot. Children also had declining poverty rates, not quite as dramatic, and their gains were not as secure, so that in the last 10 years, as we've seen poverty start to creep back up, it's been more dramatically for children than it has been for the elderly. And that's because of the families that poor children are in are not benefiting from, don't have the same programs available to them that elderly people do for their support.
Now, how does the U.S. compare when we're looking at child poverty with other developed nations?
Well, the interesting thing about our poverty is that we have a higher poverty rates when you after you take into account government support, taxes, and transfers. So the number of people we have at low incomes is not actually that much higher than other countries. But we do less to reduce poverty. So the government does less to compensate for the fact that people have lower incomes. So, for example, the poverty rate for single mothers and their children in this country is much higher than it is in most of Western and Northern Europe.
Is the war on poverty over? Did it ever have an end point, or is it something that just sort of trickled away?
Well, the political sociologist David Meyer commented today that it was unfortunate to call it a war on poverty because that's very difficult to ever declare victory in or finish. But in some ways, I would say we don't have one now. It's not so much won or lost, but we don't have a concerted, coordinated campaign across different areas of government, state and local and federal government, and different programs with a goal of eliminating poverty. We have a patchwork of different programs with different justifications, and some are more sort of stigmatized or considered to be more that people deserve more, like unemployment benefits. Most people think workers are laid off should get those, but welfare for mothers, single mothers, we feel, you know, the political discourse is more negative toward them, and so on. So we don't have a coordinated program, and in that sense, it's not so much won or lost as much as we sort of just wandered away from it.
Do you think we need another war on poverty, at least to sort of reinvest ourselves as a society in ending poverty, or is there something else entirely needed right now?
Well, you know, there's a fairly simple way. If poverty is defined as not having income sufficient to meet needs, if we did something like a guaranteed income, we could end poverty. And you can do that by a reverse income tax at low incomes or by guaranteeing government jobs to people who don't have jobs. And these things are costly, although not that costly compared to what we're doing. We could do that. You know, that's a political decision. It doesn't obviously seem like anything like that's going to happen immediately, but I don't see why that sort of vision should not be at least within the realm of possibility.
And yet it's not something that you hear talked seriously about right now. Why is that?
Well, that's a good question. I think we have a very strong political streak in this country towards blaming poor people for being poor, towards not wanting to spend our money to help them in sort of an us-them perspective. And I think it's unfortunate that we don't have this sort of collective sense that a dollar spent helping a poor child is something that we're all going to benefit from down the road. I mean, it's not that we don't do anything, and certainly you know, even in this partisan environment, we don't have people who are at least not very successful politicians saying things like we should eliminate food stamps or Medicaid, and we're expanding medical care for some people. But we just don't have the collective will to do it at the moment.
Now, there is a sense now among some people that, you know, the time has come for an emphasis on personal accountability, that people need to be responsible for taking care of themselves and that they shouldn't, you know, rely on the government as much to get them out of poverty. How do you place that, you know, in a framework of poverty when you're looking at, you know, children who are below the poverty line, families? How does that square with personal accountability now?
Well, a personal accountability, I think, is sort of a it's more of an expression than a reality. Nobody's making it alone in this society, and everybody is either being helped by somebody or has been helped by somebody in the past. And of course, some people work harder than others and are more committed to succeeding than others. But the people who are poor in this country are not don't work less or try harder by and large than the people who are not poor. If you look at the jobs that the working poor do, they're not easier jobs or jobs that people don't work hard at doing. If you're talking about cooking and cleaning and carrying heavy loads and working outdoors and all those things that people do who are trying to get by or working two jobs that are part-time jobs. And, of course, children and the elderly who are not able to work and provide for themselves. We simply can't have that conversation with them. So it's not a fruitful way of framing the conversation, in my opinion.
Now, one of the contributors to this has said that one of the myths is that about poverty is that the government can't do anything about it. Where do you think that comes from? And do you think there's anything to that idea?
Well, there is a there's a line of thinking that says, you know, we spend billions and billions of dollars and we still have poor people, and so therefore nothing can be done. But and one of the things I do in the report the Council on Contemporary Families published today is just, you know, I just put in a table form some of the programs that we do have and that reduce that we know reduce the number of people living below the means needed to survive. You know, the food stamps, the earned income tax credit, women's, infants, and children's support. These are things that we spend money on right now, and they reduce poverty and reduce suffering and hardship and make lives more tolerable for people who are working and struggling to get by. And there's no reason to think we can't do those things or more.
We're talking right now with Philip Cohen, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the senior fellow at the Council on Contemporary Families, talking about where the war on poverty has gone since it started in 1964 and what is needed going forward.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts on those questions. Did the war on poverty, do you think, have successes? And what failures did you see? Did it end without success? Should there be a new war on poverty today, or should it be called something different? Give us a call. Here's how. You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Your thoughts and your questions for our guest, for that matter. You can also send an email. You can reach us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We always welcome your thoughts and feelings on the Central Time Facebook page as well. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're back in Central Time. Rob Ferret here.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're speaking now with Philip Cohen, a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the senior fellow at the Council on Contemporary Families, talking about the war on poverty, which began in 1964, looking at where we've been and the victories and failures that have come our way since then.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts. Did the war on poverty have successes? What were its failures? What do you think should change? Should there be a new anti-poverty effort? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
We'll go to the phones now and take Deborah from Waukegan, Illinois. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I have two comments that kind of are different ends of the same spectrum. And the contextually for me, these programs I don't think have ever really worked in this country because they've never been done right. You know, they've never been part of a concerted, unified, since the New Deal possibly, and even the New Deal was pretty haphazard. There's always been this context of having to shove something through. And in particular, the particular comment I wanted to make is that I was around when the Great Society began, and it made me much more of a gradualist because I think, first of all, Lyndon Johnson knew where the bodies were buried. He sort of shoved that through. Obviously, he had the context of the Kennedy assassination, and there was a listening for it, but it was very hastily put together. It didn't make any sense. Many large government programs don't make sense when they start, but in order to succeed, things like this need a long view and the ability to tweak. And in some ways, Medicare has kind of had that. I mean, Medicare is, it's very klutzy, but it's grown and developed over the years, and it's been a relatively successful program. But we have not had the same attitude in working with the poor. You know, when I began as a child welfare worker, you couldn't even reveal there was a man in the house. And there have just been cumbersome, stupid punitive regulations surrounding most of these programs. And I think they've just never offered enough. They've always been grudging.
Mm-hmm. All right. So Deborah, thank you so much for that thought. And I want to put that question to Philip Cohen. You know, have we been sort of piecemeal in our effort to affect policies and not really, you know, been in it for the long haul?
Well, yeah, I think that's a really good observation. I mean, some of our key programs like food stamps and school lunch have always sort of been half about subsidizing agriculture and half about feeding poor people. And if you look at the our medical system has been largely organized around the needs of pharmaceutical and insurance companies. You could say if you were going to draw the system from scratch with the goal of eliminating poverty, this is definitely not how you would do it. But that's the political reality we live in. I do sort of like the idea of something you could lay over the top, like a guaranteed income, a reverse income tax, where you say at the end of the year, if you meet some basic criteria, if your income has been below a certain amount, we're going to supplement it up to that amount. Most people are working. If they're not working at jobs, they're working taking care of their children. I don't think that would be too much of a crime to subsidize the few people who are lazy and took advantage of it. And the truth is they would spend that money, and that money would generate jobs and income for other people anyway. So, if you took a systematic approach and drew a line and said, we're just not as a society going to let people live in their cars or live below a certain level of income or have to work two or three jobs to feed their children. I mean, a person today working a minimum wage job, 2,000 hours, so 40 hours a week for 50 weeks, is only earning 80% of the poverty line for a family of three. So if we just raise that floor a little, I think we could all sleep a little better at night knowing that we were running a slightly more humane society.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Deborah. And let's move next to Rachel in Madison. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there. Thanks for the show. And based on what your guest just said, I'm changing my comments as we speak. But anyhow, a while ago you had asked what might be a better name for the war on poverty. And my name is Justice for All.
What do you like about that name as opposed to a war on poverty?
Well, it denotes equity and a sort of the American values of everyone is equally valuable as a citizen. And I think it's inspired in part by many of us in Madison and around the state had a good friend pass away this year, Gene Farley, who was a family physician and promoted public health and the single-payer system all around the state. He and his wife, who are both physicians, promoted that. But not the reason for my call. I mean, his slogan was, everyone in, no one out. But while you were speaking, I was really touched by, as being a school teacher, I saw so many kids, I'll just take Madison, over half of our kids in school are living under the poverty line, federal poverty line. And much of the criterion for that is based on who is eligible for free and reduced lunch.
And I want to get our guest take on that. Thank you for the call, Rachel. And curious about whether justice should be part of the conversation on poverty. Is that any way to frame it? Or has that always been a thread there, Philip?
Well, I that appeals to me, and it appeals to a sizable minority of the American public, I think. I would be happy to frame the conversation that way. I think one way to think about the question of fairness and equity is, and when we think about the way the welfare reform is handled, it's all been about work, and people have to work or they're not going to get support from their fellow citizens through the government. But I started to say before, just about everybody does work. Some people maybe never get off the couch for whatever reason. They're probably mentally ill. But the people who have children and can't get a job or a job that pays enough, people who can't manage to hold a job while they are taking care of their family responsibilities, that's work. It's productive. It takes effort. It takes creativity. It produces something of value that other people benefit from. And the idea of spreading resources around to help make sure that people who do that kind of work are also cared for, to me, I guess justice is a good word for it. It also seems like common sense.
Now, we've seen a lot of income stagnation, especially among the middle class over the past several years, maybe going back farther than that. How has that affected the rates of poverty in this country?
Well, the way I see that is sort of that the programs that we have are swimming against the tide. And one of the tides we have is rising inequality or falling wages for a certain sizable segment of the population, basically the people who don't have higher education. I have in the report that, you know, people with men, especially with less than a college degree, have had their year-round earnings fall at from 5 to 10% in the last 20 years. That's really hard to it's hard to organize an economy in a society when you have a large portion of the population with falling incomes, and that's for full-time year-round workers. The college graduates may have insecurity and hardship of their own, but income poverty is mostly not their problem. But we've seen a pulling apart of the top and the bottom, and that's a challenge economically, and it's a challenge to support the people at the bottom. But it's also a challenge politically because it opens up a divide in the experience of how people see the world between those who are at the bottom and those who are above that chasm between them.
What would you like to tell people or urge people to do to think differently about the people experiencing poverty in our country as they make policies and they just inform attitudes? What would you tell them?
Well, I'd like us to recognize the work that people do, even if they're not getting paid for it, is work, especially childcare and caring for people in their own families, and something that we all benefit from. And I guess I'd encourage people to think creatively. If you imagine the big pots of money and resources that we have in a very wealthy society, and say, how could we move these resources around instead of thinking in terms of the narrow programs and policies that we have right now? Back up a little and think, how would we do it if we were going to start from scratch? And think creatively. I mean, if it's difficult if you're trying to write the policy, but we're average citizens. We don't have to worry about the details right now. We can argue about the vision and the goal for what kind of society we want to live in, and then try to bring about the politics to make it happen.
Philip, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for calling.
We've been speaking to Philip Cohen, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the senior fellow at the Council on Contemporary Families. We've been talking about what's happened with the war on poverty since it started in 1964.
Coming up, today's Wisconsin Life finds out how some Wisconsin preppers are getting ready for the end of the world as we know it. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to a guest who says politicians should shoot for emotional correctness instead of political correctness.
But first, we're exploring the world of doomsday preppers, people making preparations for major disasters. Judging by the popularity of dystopian books and movies like The Hunger Games, Americans seem to love a good post-apocalypse story.
But the potential for a doomsday disaster isn't just fiction to people in preppers groups. In today's Wisconsin Life, Steph Jovog takes us inside the Madison preppers.
Nuclear war, global pandemics, floods, fires, famine. If the world came crashing down, would you be ready?
I think we live in the society of denial. Government's going to be there because I voted for them, and they're going to come and help me, and they're going to save the day. They're superheroes.
That's Kurt LaHaye. He's a former cop and firefighter who leads a group called the Madison Preppers.
Group started in March of 2012. As of today, looking at it, I think there's 209 members. We cover everything from planning for disasters or emergencies up into canning, beekeeping, gardening, security, self-defense, water purification. I tell everybody, you're your own first responder. You're your own security or police. You're your own fire and EMS. You're your own grocery store. You got to know all those things.
Kurt was raised in Southern California by his grandparents, a do-it-yourself couple that grew their own vegetables and stored them in root cellars, who fixed stuff when it broke. Kurt wanted to be that way. As an adult, he lived through earthquakes and wildfires. He once had to evacuate his home, an experience that changed him.
The first time it happened, I was like, what do I grab? Where am I going? Hotel? Is my house going to be here? All my stuff going to be gone?
In his basement in the town of Bristol, Kurt shows me his prepper's stash.
There's more.
Shelves stocked with supplies like rope, gloves, and generators, even canisters of potassium iodine to counteract radioactive contamination.
Yeah, I've got, well, that's canned dog food, pink salmon, chicken, tomato paste, freeze-dried foods, dehydrated foods,
staples.
Emergency food ration bars, canned goods. I mean, I've got Sterno for cooking on.
Soups, stews, beans.
Gotta have
chili.
Water. So water filters. Several of them.
Grills outside.
Spam. Yeah, canned butter. Actually tried it. Nice, good stuff.
I asked Kurt if he was paranoid.
No. I have friends that say that know what I do, and I talked to them about it, and they said, oh, you're paranoid. I said, no, I'm prepared. Or preparanoid. People are, well, you're wasting money. Well, I'm like, well, do you have car insurance? Yeah. I said, have you ever used it? No, fortunately. Do you waste money doing that? You've never used it. Do you need it? Do I think that the world's going to end tomorrow? No. Hope it doesn't. But could it? Yeah, maybe it could. I don't know.
Prepping, Kurt says, isn't crazy. Instead, it harkens back to the age-old American ideals of self-reliance.
I don't think it's anything new. I think it's just reborn, I guess. Being self-sufficient, self-reliant, being prepared.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janning. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Now, freelance journalist Seth Jovog joins us here in the studio to tell us more about the Madison Preppers. Seth, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, good to be here.
So Kurt is not the only one in this group. You said, I think, over 200, he mentioned in that piece. This is one of the biggest ones in the state, as I understand it, which doesn't match the Madison stereotype, I guess.
Yeah, I was just looking again today. It's actually 244 right now on the meetup group for Madison Preppers. The ones in Milwaukee and the Fox Valley don't have as many members, and they're not as active. They don't have as many meetings. The group in Madison, they meet in the town of Bristol, which is outside of Sun Prairie. So it's not in Madison, but the majority of members come from Dane County or just outside. So it's not just a standalone Madison group, but there was a fair amount of interest, you know, locally here for this group.
Was there a fair amount of self-consciousness that an outsider maybe like you would think of them as paranoid or strange in some way?
Yeah, I went into it. I was expecting that they'd be a little wary of me. And before I went to the first meeting, I actually talked to Kurt, who's kind of the engine behind the group and who is the leader of it. And I wanted to make clear that I wanted to, you know, observe and everything like that. And he was okay with that. And we had a good conversation. Then he introduced me to kind of ease some of those concerns people might had. That being said, you know, people also were a little hesitant to give their names because there is a stigma attached to preppers as being, you know, sort of a lunatic fringe or something like that. And I think maybe they are wary of being dragged through the mud publicly or something like that. But so, yeah, there's a little wariness. But everyone that I spoke to was very open with me about why they're interested. And yeah.
Let's follow up. We heard Kurt's motivation. What were some of the other motivations you heard from the people there?
I guess that was part of the interest for me is that it was pretty wide range. You know, some people, everybody brought different interests and skills, I guess, to the table. Some people, you know, what are you prepping for is a big question. You know, like some people are prepping for something mundane, like, well, outside today it's 15 degrees below zero. What happens if the power goes out in your city or your region? How would I be prepared for that? Which is a good question. And other people were, you know, preparing for longer range things. It really runs the gamut. You know, be it pandemics or natural disasters or climate change or, you know, economic collapse. So I guess their motivations were sort of across the board.
So not everyone has this apocalyptic vision of a bad thing that could happen, but it could be a tornado or a flood.
Right, right. And I think, you know, TV shows like Doomsday Preppers have popularized preppers or as a whole. But, of course, those shows show the extremes of people who are prepping for zombies and the collapse of the world and things like that. And the reality is probably a little bit more mundane.
Some of the things that people are talking about, gardening, beekeeping, it seems like a lot of people could just extend their hobbies a little bit and be preppers at the same time without a lot of extra investment.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. And actually, while I was working on the story and talking to friends and neighbors about what I was working on, I was surprised by how many people mentioned that they've thought about this topic or they do a little bit of what might be considered prepping, you know, because it does cover, like you said, a lot of different hobbies that are basically, you know, getting ready for, you know, just being prepared for whatever may come. Yeah.
And one of those things they prepare for may be violence. You mentioned self-defense. How big, and I think when people think of preppers, sometimes it's like canned food and shotguns. How big a part of their conversations center around self-defense?
Well, the meetings I went to didn't have that as a focus. However, there were other meetings that focused on, you know, use of firearms for self-defense, use of firearms or air rifles for hunting. I think that firearms can be a big part of it for some preppers. I think for some preppers, it's probably not a part of it at all. But there is definitely an element in prepping. If you go online and just start reading, you'll hear that there's the idea that, hey, people who haven't prepped, if things do go very wrong in our world, those who haven't prepped are going to come after those who have prepped, and they're going to want to take their stuff. So you might need to protect your stuff, and that might involve firearms, which is, that's when it gets pretty ugly, I guess.
And the group you saw at the meetings, more men, more women, solid mix?
There was a mix. There were some married couples there. There was, it was pretty... I think I counted, I'm trying to remember what the count was, but it was almost 50-50 men and women. And it was, the age ranges, mostly middle-aged, but there was some younger and some older.
What kind of skills are at the top of people's lists to be ready for whatever might happen?
Well, you mentioned, or in the piece you mentioned some, like canning and things like that. I think really it's almost like advanced camping skills. You know, do you have water? Do you have food? Do you know how much food you would need if for 3 days or 3 weeks or whatever it may be beyond that? So I think there's sort of that, advanced camping skills is a big thing people want. There was also people who came who had, decades of experience with herbal remedies, and gathering their own food from the wild. So it really runs a gamut.
I know community disaster groups in places like San Francisco often focus on building teams, knowing your neighbors, cooperating in the event of, say, an earthquake, checking in on your neighbors who need help, checking in on senior citizens. Any talk about that?
You know, there wasn't in the meetings that I went to, and that was sort of a question I had to Kurt was, I kind of have this idea that, my neighbors and friends would come to each other's aid and we'd figure things out together. And he said, his answer to that was, well, maybe, but you don't know if things really went bad, how would it go? And that might be, I don't know, I don't want to speak for preppers, but that might be a criticism of some preppers. It's like, well, are you retreating and pulling away and just looking out for yourself? Or are you looking for ways that you could help others? Some preppers would say that by being prepared, they're going to be in a position to help others if things went really bad. So that's another way to look at it.
Have you evaluated, Seth, your own preparation level should something bad happen since meeting with the Madison Preppers?
Yeah, sure. I thought about it, and I went online and I did a test, and I did really poorly. I went to the Doomsday Preppers website, and I took a test to see how prepared I was in case things went badly. And I would last about a week or two, and then I would die. But the other people, the really good preppers would go 17 or 18 months if just everything went horribly, I guess. I'm not a prepper. I was just thinking about that this morning when it was bitterly cold and looking around. I was like, okay, I have some candles and I have a camp stove. But, I don't have much else in the way of preparations. And maybe I should do a little bit better, especially on days like today. But it hasn't drastically changed, what I want to do.
So you haven't gone out and stocked up on canned food or anything?
No, I don't have the freeze-dried meals or anything like that right now. So.
All right. Anything else that struck you about prepping culture here in Wisconsin that people might not expect?
I guess it was, like I said, it was a little bit more mundane than I thought at times. People were just like, hey, let's figure out these skills together that a lot of people have questions about, gardening and beekeeping and canning and things like that. I went into it expecting a little bit more of the lunatic fringe that you see on TV, and I came away with a little less of that.
Seth, thanks a lot for joining us again.
You bet.
That's Seth Jovog, freelance journalist in Madison.
Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who makes the case that politicians should try to be emotionally correct, not politically correct. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Up next, it's the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.